All right, so a good chunk of you guys voted to have the test a week from today. Hopefully you got an email about that. It will cover everything we make it through today. So we'll kind of freeze what's going to be on the test from today's lecture. So what's Thursday, you'll get tested on eventually, but it won't show up on Tuesday's test. That makes sense?
Yeah.
what I'll do also, based on that, based on what we get through today, I'll post an outline, essentially, of what you can expect, the material you need to know that's on the test. All right, so I'll take care of that. I'm not trying to trick you or hide stuff from you in terms of what's going to be there. So, what I'm also going to do is list a few problems from the recent stuff. I know you guys haven't had problems from that yet. I'll list them. It'll probably be after 201 today, so probably 6 or 7 o'clock tonight before I can get it posted. I'll hold the solutions to those until Friday, so you'll have a chance. I would highly recommend you work them on your own and then check them against my solutions, which I'll post on Friday. So you'll have the weekend and early part of next week to compare.
You want to turn those in, or is that just?
I think given the timing, I'm not going to ask them for you. It doesn't feel fair to just give you like 3 days to do them. But I think it is in your best interest to do them, obviously. Yeah.
Is that kind of in place of homework?
Well, what we're going to do is probably, again, if you look at the schedule, I pushed. Pushed an updated schedule soon after we rescheduled the exam. We pushed some of that stuff back. So there will be a homework kind of almost immediately following the exam, with probably chapter 5 stuff. So most of the homework will be chapter 4. And we'll get to the very beginning of chapter 5, which I think will be fair game for the test because it's kind of high-level intuitive understanding of what parameters change what in a response. So I think that'll be on there. But then there'll be a homework that will have some more rigorous math stuff, basically. I think for the exam, just to kind of give you guys a heads up, remember I'm not trying to test necessarily your math skills or calculus skills or differential equation skills. Some of it obviously is essential to understand what's going on. But just kind of keep that in mind. I'm trying to test, do you understand the controls stuff? Okay, so. If you can explain what's happening intuitively and your math's still not right, I'm going to do my best to help you out, provided you've provided some kind of clear explanation. I'm not a Hibbler grader where it's just completely wrong or right. I'm looking more, I'm trying to gauge your understanding, basically. So keep that in mind when you're working. Okay. So we'll march through. We should be able to wrap up kind of the core topics of Chapter 4 in the next 15 minutes or so. And we'll start outlining... actually gets us, what we get through today will get us enough skills to where we can start doing interesting labs. So that's been one hold up. I don't want to give you guys just busy work. So so we're going to talk first about steady state error. So what is steady state error? What's steady state for a system? I think you are fine up until the very last part. You can have steady state oscillation, actually.
Things stop changing.
Yeah, so steady state really means the system is in this state and it's going to be that way forever. Right. So, for example, you could have oscillation if you have a steady force input that's going on forever. You can have steady state oscillation in response to that. And actually, that's a big chunk of vibrations, if you guys take vibrations, is looking at steady state responses for oscillatory systems. But yeah, basically steady state, how does a system behave as time goes out to infinity? Right? And you're making kind of the assumption that there's been enough time to where any kind of transient startup type effects have gone away. So the system is behaving this way, has been behaving this way for as far back in time as you can see, and is behaving this way for as far forward in the future as we can see. So let's look at steady state error of an open loop system, like this one, all right? So we can still get the measure of error. Let's measure error just like we would for the closed loop system. And error y minus r, let's do r minus y, sorry. Keep it consistent with the closed loop one. We don't really just change the sign, right? Okay. Well, if we look at this, what's y? G GP, GC times R, right? So there we have an expression for the error of this open loop system to some kind of input R. Okay. So how can we get some, how can we quantify steady state error? What's that theorem called? Not quite. I'll draw up one part of it for you. Limit give you that much of it.
Oh, with the S's.
With the S's, yes. That's what I'm looking for.
S approaches zero?
As S approaches zero, that's part of it.
Y of S?
Y of S is part of it.
S
Y of S. There you go. What's that called? Not really. I mean, we have some Laplace stuff built into it, but it's the final value theorem. So we can actually look, we can look at the error as well. That works for any time signal. Now we can look at the error in steady state, not just the response. Okay. So let's do that. All right. For any kind of response R, we know what the error is in steady state by solving that. Okay. Let's look at, for this open loop system, look at that response to a unit step input. What is R of S for a unit, or what's a unit step in the Laplace domain? 1 over s, yeah. Okay. So we can take that guy, plug him in here. Yeah, we'll go up here. Okay, so these guys cancel, right? So we have that the error is all right. So we're going to define something a little bit new here. If we plug in S is zero for the into these two transfer functions, remember these are both functions of S. If we plug in 0 as we would to take this limit, you write it that way. And this guy it's called the DC gain of that system. Okay, or the DC gain of that transfer function in this case, the combined transfer function. So that's going to be a parameter we look at pretty consistently when we're analyzing control systems. So if we want the error to go to zero, what do we need the DC gain to be?
One,
right? We want this piece to go to zero. So we want the DC gain. The DC gain has to be exactly one for that error to go to zero in the steady state. How often do you think that happens? Very rarely. I won't say never. You get pretty close to one, right? So typically not equal to exactly one, let's say. So you might get something small and end up with small amounts of error in the steady state. But for it to be exactly one, and for you to be able to get exactly zero error, yeah, that probably does never happen outside of simulation. Okay. So how do we fix that? What can we do better than this? There we go. Close the loop. All right, so we have a system What's the transfer function of that? Anybody able to do that block diagram? You'll see this one enough where this will be one you just remember, I think, eventually. So what's y over r?
I over r is 1 over 1 plus gc gp.
I agree with that part. I agree with that. So from that, we could actually pretty easily get, how do I get from y back to e? I'm working backwards. So I'm working this way in the transfer function, I'm multiplying, right? Gc. Why is that, right? So then what's e? Yeah. From there, though.
Y over gcgp.
Right. So if I know that, I know I basically can get to this guy, e over r, just by dividing y over r by gcgp. I can kind of take that shortcut. See some confused looks. Let's go ahead. Where that? That's why, right? So those cancel, divide by r, and we'll get to that. Okay. So let's take the final value theorem of this to our step input, right? So to a unit step, we can do the limit. We have those S's cancel. Okay. So what can we say about this, if anything, in terms of the error, steady state error?
Is it the same?
Not quite. So in this case, I wanted the DC gain to be exactly 1. What do I want the DC gain over here to be? Right, that's still the DC gain, actually, GCGP. Yeah, I want it to be as big as I can. Right, the bigger this is, right, the smaller this quantity is. Right? And then in the limit, if it goes to infinity, then you add my error goes to 0. Right. So for this case, basically want it to be as large as possible. I want the DC gain of that system to be huge. That's what's going to let me reject or react to this unit step input with little error in steady state. That makes sense intuitively? Yes? No? Maybe? Why? Well, think about, I'm asking kind of physically if we have the system, what's happening, right? GP is kind of fixed, right? I mean, that's our plant. We can't usually change that much.
Right. Is it because the larger you make your transfer functions, the more robust they are to the changes, like it's more input kind of thing?
I think that's what this is showing us, basically. The last sentence you said is it, though. Yeah, right. So I can't change GP, generally, right? So to make this big, I need to make GC large.
So that's like on the first example, with the box on the wheels.
Yeah.
If you push it really hard, the wind pushing it back will be nothing.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Right. So if I'm making GC very large, right, I get a huge control input for even a little bit of air. We thought about there's some kind of U in there. And GC just acts on the error. It takes the error as an input, does some stuff to it to generate some kind of, figure out some kind of input to the plant, the physical system. So this is huge. It only takes a little bit of error before I start pushing on the system to try to get rid of it. All right. And if it's huge, I get a really big input, which hopefully drives Y to R quickly, or will drive Y to R quickly. Making some sense? Okay. We'll see after the midterm the trouble with making GC very large. Can get worse than that, actually. Gets too large, this actually can end up going to infinity over time. So, but don't worry about that yet. Okay. So we have some kind of trade-off here, right? We see there's some benefit maybe to having this closed loop form. I think we've seen that a few times without even really thinking about what needs to be in GC. Right? It's going to let us do some things that we can't do with just the open loop. The next thing we're going to look at are some common, we're already kind of doing this, but we're going to formalize a way to look at kind of common test benchmark inputs. We talked about the step input, right, and we've used it here as a benchmark. You don't always, or you probably usually shouldn't give your system a step input. Right? But it does provide a benchmark against which we can compare different responses in different systems. So let's do that. Questions about this before I erase it? Good? All right. Chapter 5 is all about performance of feedback control systems. But in actuality, most of the things we're going to discuss would apply to any kind of transfer function, even if it wasn't really a feedback-based transfer function. Okay. Let's look at our the inputs we're going to most commonly use to kind of test control system or system performance. Right. Test endpoints, inputs. First one we have looked at a few times already. So maybe we'll kind of plow through this one quickly. I'm going to write the, let's call it R. RFT for a step input looks like what? Or is what? Zero up to some point. Let's call that point zero times zero. And then it's something else, a constant otherwise. A is some constant. All right, so we've looked primarily at unit step inputs. Could be of any size. Could be negative if you want it to be. All right. This also can happen somewhere other than t equals 0. So you can have a step input that happens at t equals 1. All right, and it's just 0 up until that point and then A after that time. All right. What is, I did this once already today, but just to be complete about it, what's the
one over s
is what kind of step input? Unit. It's a unit. What's the step of size A? A over S, right. Step input looks like that. And of course, we can maybe drop a little step. I'm going to put 0 there so we can see the change. Instantaneous change, and then constant before. Constant before and after. Can any real system do this? Let's keep that in mind. Doesn't make it less useful as a test input, right? This could be a change, and quite often it'll be a change in a desired position. Like the actual system can't change like that, but you want it to change as quick as possible. Yes.
What if it's like an electrical system where the
still have time? It gets really small if it's just electrical or light, electromagnetic, let's say. But they're actually still, if you look at a small enough time scale, it's still not a step. Those are step inputs. Another one we'll look at. Step will be the most common, for sure. A ramp input. What do you think a ramp input as a function of time looks like? And we'll say it starts at 0. All time less than 0 is 0. All right. What's the Laplace representation? Not quite. A over s squared, right? How'd you get there to the s squared part?
Instead of having a derivative of time, you have time. So instead of s.
Yeah. What's the relationship between these two? You kind of said it. Right. This is the derivative of that. Right. This is the derivative of that. So this is s times the ramp, or the other way, this is the integral of that, so this is 1 over s times the step. Ramp inputs, probably don't really need to draw these for you guys, but we will. In that case, the slope is a. And this last one we won't use hardly ever, really, for mechanical systems. What do you think a parabolic input looks like then? And it's a plus. Times two, you're right about that. Thank you. And then you end up with parabola starting times zero. All right, one more chord that actually shows up more often and sometimes behind the scenes than the ramp or parabolic input. I'm going to draw up a plot of this one first because we're going to reason through exactly what's going on. So so we're going to say call it that, and I'm going to define a little bit differently than the book. They make it symmetric about zero. It works either way. I guess I should put a zero. So between zero and eta, some small value, or epsilon, sorry. Zero and epsilon, where epsilon is some small value, it has amplitude 1 over epsilon. Yeah. No, because the derivative is just, well, derivative is like, so s times this would be like the derivative. Right. So remember, taking derivatives in a Laplace domain is just like a multiplying by an s. So the derivative coming this way just cancels out those s's. Okay. So we have, this is actually a pulse. When we look at this, as that small value epsilon gets smaller and smaller, all right, what happens to the amplitude?
Or as e gets smaller,
mm-hmm. It's bigger. And bigger how? As epsilon goes to zero. Yeah, it gets infinitely large. And the duration of the impulse, right, which, well, I'm kind of saying the same thing, goes towards zero. So in the limit, we end up with a function called the Dirac delta. It has infinite amplitude and zero duration. All right. It has a few important properties. That its integral over all time is 1. You don't really get into why that is. The second one does show up. We're not really going to talk about it in a huge amount of detail, but just know that this property is key to the convolution integral. You'll see that 45. If you end up taking that, if you take that and taking it with me, that's chapter 3 in the book I use. Talks about that. And what this does basically allows us, the convolution integral allows you to represent any arbitrary input as an infinite series of impulses. So if you know the impulse response and the response to one impulse, you're just going to add those together via superposition and get it to set arbitrary input. It's kind of an interesting technique. So for example, there's like the forced input command in Python or LSIM in MATLAB. Are using this behind the scenes to get the solution. All right. There are common test inputs. Of these, the step, this is the most common, and then maybe impulse response, depending on what you're working in. These will show up in some special cases. Questions about any of those? All right, because we're going to start looking at performance measures to step inputs. You can leave that up, I think. One key thing to remember about these is these are test inputs. These are not the only options you have to control a system. It's kind of a common mistake for beginning controls engineer. I have to use a step or I have to use a ramp. You can use whatever you want. These just happen to make analysis convenient. Mathematically, generally. Okay. Look at the performance of second order systems, section 5.3. What does a second order transfer function look like? What distinguishes a second order from third order, from seventh order, from a hundredth order?
Exponents.
Yeah, the exponents. So it's the largest exponent in the denominator, right? So if we have a second order transfer function, we'll talk about probably one of the most common ones we're going to see. That guy. This is a second order oscillatory system, often called a second order harmonic oscillator. So remember that omega n is a natural frequency of that system. And that zeta is the damping ratio. What does the natural frequency tell me about the system?
It was left alone, how it would oscillate.
Sure. How it naturally oscillates. What frequency it naturally oscillates at. What about the damping ratio?
It tells you how quickly it will reduce those oscillations.
Sure. So how quickly those oscillations die out, how quickly is energy dissipated in the system, is another way to think about it. All right. Okay. So, let's take a look at this guy. We know sure I don't have to do that step for you guys, but were they already? I want to look at the response and properties of this guy to a step input. So I know that's 1 over S. Y of S is that transfer function. And this one's actually common enough where this is going to be in most lookup tables. It's a super common transfer function form. You should be able to find that one. In fact, the table of your book has that. And you can find Y of T. Book use cosine or sine. Works either way. I missed the term already. And if you look it up, you'll see something like that. You might see it in terms of cosine. That works too. All that has to change is this phi, if you use cosine. All right, so I think we introduced this already. What's that omega d? General representation, omega d. Looks like this. What's that called? Damp natural frequency. Okay. And we'll see. That phase shift phi. And let's see, they've written it as plus. Works either way, too. So let's look at this form, right? So this gives us a time response, tells us how this system that can be represented by this transfer function is going to behave, right, if I issue it a step input, right? So we went through Laplace, got there, inverse Laplace, back to time domain, right? So we have the time response of the system. That's what that equation says. Shows how this thing evolved as a function of time. Okay. So, what can we say about it? Okay. Hang on to the sine wave part. So the sine tells us it's oscillatory. Right, there's a wave. All right. What else can we say about it? Does it go to zero? Where does it go? It goes to one, right? You look at this term, right? This t goes out to infinity. This whole thing goes to zero. You go to one, right? So it's the one. That's what we hope happens if we give the thing a unit step input, right? We want it to get to one if we're given a unit step, right? Okay, so we have what kind of one collection of terms. I could think of this guy, just hold on to that as some scaling stuff right now. All right. Well, what does this exponential term do for you? Close.
That's what, dissipates the oscillatory.
Yeah, you guys are very close. So it's actually what defines the decay envelope that this thing decays over. Right. So there's exponential decay of the sine wave. Right. This exponential function is what defines that envelope, both on plus and minus time side. Okay, so So just looking at that, if I want my oscillation to die out more quickly, what do I want zeta? What do I want to happen with zeta, my damping ratio? I want it to be big, right? Because that, this guy is going to go to zero more quickly. Okay. So let's look at the responses for a few values of zeta. And we're going to oscillate about one, let's say. Unit step input. We actually, we'll just have time. All right. And I'm going to put my zero over so we can see that response too. So we have some kind of step input. It looks like that. That's our input. All right. I need more colors. What does this response look like if zeta is zero?
We have no damping.
No damping, yeah.
It just oscillates
oscillate. Around one. Where's the positive peak at? What's the amplitude of that? Well, so zeta went to zero. This just turns into a one. Zeta 0, that goes away. What's the amplitude of sine? It most goes from plus to plus or minus 1, right? So in the undamped case, you actually end up with the response. How many cycles do I want? And that should be peaking somewhere there, not decaying. So if you don't have any damping, you try to push on a system of this form with a step input of amplitude 1, it's going to overshoot and oscillate from 0 to 2 as a result. So that tells us, hey, we probably want some damping, right? Let's add a little bit. I'm going to do .1. So what changes about this then? Should decrease at a certain rate, yes? What else changes? The amplitude peak, you mean? Yeah, amplitude over time changes. Is the peak there going to be higher or lower? It's going to gradually get lower, and it's actually going to be lower because of this thing too, that peak. All right. So you have almost the same here. It's probably a little bit too quickly damped for 0.1. All right. So yes, our peak amplitude went down some, and we're decaying towards zero now. All right. Let's do another one. Double our damping. What happens? Same stuff happens, right? We have a lower peak, and we dial even faster. More. Now what? Kind of same stuff happening, right? Yep. Lower peak dies out faster. What's happening to the frequency? I'm trying to show that here. It's a little bit hard by hand. As damping goes up, what happens to the frequency at which you're oscillating? Without damping, it doesn't change. Okay. So the damped natural frequency gets lower. Right? What does that mean for the period? It's longer. Right? So frequency slower, takes longer to complete one cycle. Right? So it's not a big change from this, but there is some change. Right, because we're oscillating about that damped natural frequency, if you have damping. All right. Let's look at two more cases, at least. Yeah, we might get fit on that plot. Let's do that. Sorry. It's two separate ones in the notes. Go back to blue and call them dash blue. In fact, what you'll see, you quite often see that, particularly in textbooks, that has some special stuff baked into it, which we'll learn about soon. Yeah, 1/√2, exactly. See why that comes up in a minute. So this guy actually just barely overshoots and then settles. Right. What happens if I keep increasing? So green was next.
You eventually don't really get any oscillation.
Yeah, when does that happen? That happens at 1. Right. That's a critically damped system. And what we'll see is, yeah, we don't get any oscillation. But the response is actually a little bit slower in some sense. Back up to these guys up top. So zeta 0, we say the system's undamped. Between 0 and 1, what do we call those? Anybody know?
Underdamped.
If critically damped, so what does zeta is? Greater than 1. Overdamped, yes. All right. And you'll also see somewhere between 0 and 0.2, maybe 0.3, you'll see those sometimes called lightly damped systems. Right. And depending on what kind of system you're talking about, that range kind of changes what's considered light damping. So if we did 0.2, we still don't have any oscillation, but now the system's kind of sluggish, if you will. It takes a while to get to that set point, and you have high damping. When might that kind of response be preferable?
At 1.
An overdamped response, let's say. When might I want a system that's overdamped?
When overshooting is a big problem.
Overshooting is a big problem. Yeah, so you'll see that some chemical processes, control of those, you'll see be kind of designed to have really high damping. All right. Any ideas of a mechanical system you might want to have high damping?
Ratios on, say, a crane, maybe? Having to move the crane arm or something?
Yeah, maybe. So if you're just looking at kind of a mechanical solution, yeah, you could have an over-damped satellite robotic arm, right? Right. If it starts, something starts oscillating in space, it tends to oscillate for a very long time, right? So any kind of overshooting oscillation is a big problem. The other one is like screen doors. They're typically over-damped, right? Well, well-designed ones are, so they don't slam into the frame and bounce back and forth. They come up and kind of slowly approach it, right? Or like modern, like trunks and things like that. The automatically opening ones are kind of over-damped, right? They're slowly approach closing and then close, right? Old school screen door just slams into the frame and bounces back and forth and makes a bunch of noise. All right. Okay. There's also a page in the notes that follows this pretty much same analysis, but for the impulse input. I think we'll skip that one here in class. Right. So same idea. You end up with the same type of trends if you look at this from an impulse perspective as well. So that's in the notes. Take a look. All right, so let's look now. We can get some very specific parameters for looking at underdamped systems. Let's do that. Am I going to need that? We can redraw. All right. All right, I'm going to draw a cleaner version of the plot we just had, hopefully. Nice and large so we have room to talk about it. So I'm just going to say that's the response. And let's say we're looking at unit step input that's happening at times zero, and we'll space over zero just so we can actually see the step. So the input, let's do. Just a unit step input. Step input. And we're going to have some second-order system response to that step input. We'll pick a relatively lightly damped version. Not the best drawing, but that'll get us there, I think. Okay. And, of course, this axis down here is time. So, for a second order system, geez, that's ugly. We actually can get approximations at least for quite a few performance parameters in some kind of closed form, actually. Okay. So, the first one we're going to look at. Called rise time. And you'll see that defined is the time it takes your system to move from 10 to 90% of its final set point. So let's look at that. That is the rise time in this case. You might often see, I'll put it in. Sometimes you'll see 0 to 100. Well, how long does it take you to get from where you started to pass through the initial to the final set point the first time? Right. The 10 to 90 works for a larger range of types of systems, so it's more common, I would say. Okay. So rise time. What does that tell us about system performance? Yeah, kind of how quickly do we respond to inputs? Yeah, something like that, right? I slam on the gas, how quickly do I change speed? Okay, let's look at another one. It's called settling time. Time it takes the response to settle to within plus or minus some percentage delta of the final set point. Okay. 2%. And 5% are the most common. So you hear people talk about the 2% settling time or the 5% settling time for a system. So if I define, I have some, let's see. Some bounds there. The time from when the command started to when I enter that band and then never exit. Settling time, not rise time. Kind of makes sense. How quickly do I settle into something close to my final value? All right. So let's take a look at settling time in a little bit more detail. Right. We saw that. Actually, skip rewriting that. What part of that time response dictated how quickly I settled to my final value? Which term in that equation? Yeah, the exponential, the decay envelope. Right. So as an approximation, whenever I have this decay envelope, whenever it gets to within plus or minus delta percent of the set point, my response should be pretty close to that same time in crossing that boundary. So we can use that as an approximation, right? So what we can say we want to find when that happens, when that decay envelope has come down to 0.02 or 2%. And so we want that. And so that's 4, not 0.4. We can get an approximation of our settling time to be that. Or you'll see it sometimes written like this. Where 1 over zeta omega n defines one of the time constants of the system. This holds for second order systems. and can be used as an approximation for higher order systems, given some certain conditions. So what is it? What can you learn about maybe trying to pick zeta and omega n for a system? What does a higher zeta do for you? Yeah. All right, so you want, if you want really high settling time, you want zeta times omega n to be as high as it can be, given the other constraints of your system. Right, because the bigger this is, the smaller that quantity is, the faster you're going to settle. Hang on to that. We're going to get exactly that trade-off. I think we're going to have time. Okay. Let's look. I'm trying to keep it on this board. Let's call TP the peak time. And as you might expect, that's the time of the maximum amplitude response. How do I figure out what that time is? If I know the equation for y of t for the system, right? How could I figure out what time tp occurs at? Yeah, I could just do it numerically and figure out what the max is, right? Numerically. Could I do it analytically? Probably yes, since I'm asking about it, right? What's the slope up here?
Zero.
Zero, right? So you can just take the derivative of y of t and find the first place that it's zero after time zero. Right. And that's going to give you that peak time. Right. So we find that, actually for these systems it's exactly that. Pi over omega d, yeah. We have an expression for that peak time. For these second order systems. So we really can start mapping out already kind of what the response looks like given some parameters, right? If we know zeta and omega n, we know how things are going to respond. We should be sketch it by hand even, right? All right. So if I know the peak time, let's define another parameter. Call that overshoot. If we have some set point and we're trying to get to it and we go past it, we've overshot it. We have overshoot. All right. So those kind of guys are separate. You'll quite often see the peak response labeled MP. So if I know for this system, I know that since I had a set point of 1, right? What else could I say about that peak? When does it happen? At the peak time. So if I know y is a function of t, I can just plug in TP there and get the value of that peak. Okay. And if I did that, if we had thrown that equation up, you could fill in values. It's going to be 1 plus... Yeah. So this is just e to that stuff, but I wrote it exponential, so it's not so tiny. And there you have an expression for the peak. right? We had one for peak time as well. What do you think percentage overshoot tells you? Question, or are you just stretching? Okay. Yeah, it's some kind of relationship between, we're kind of trying to normalize how far you've overshot, right? So it's not just about one. If this is 10, that we want kind of the percentage should be the same if it's a linear system, actually. Yeah. So you can write that way. You also could write kind of where that FV is the final value, right? For systems like the one we're talking about right now, that is the set point. We see if we have some other systems, we're not always guaranteed to decay to the final set point, the command set point. Okay. So for a unit step, in this case, final value is 1. We have a second order system. We can write that percent overshoot. A pi back here too. I'm sorry. So for the peak, that pi is the same one that shows up there. Sorry about that. So what can you say about overshoot as damping goes up? Yeah, you get less and less overshoot. Right. And eventually out at 1, the overshoot goes away. Right. And that's actually not a linear relationship. So out of here, 1 looks something like this. It's exponential, right? There's a prettier plot of this in the notes and one in the book. All right. So we got all these nice things defined now. Question then is, looking at all these parameters for these kind of second order systems, what should zeta and omega n be if we have choice over them?
Depends on what's more important.
Depends on what's more important. So you're implying there's some kind of compromise here.
Yep.
What compromise exists?
Wait, what?
So you said it depends on what's most important.
As you're rising.
Rise time. Okay. Let's look. The rise time is hard to actually get a closed form solution for. Over some range of damping, you get an approximation. The book gives you an approximation. We'll use theirs and it'll help us kind of reason about what's going on. And this, their approximation, he says, is valid over a decent range of damping. Okay. So I think that's going to help you make your argument, maybe. As my damping increases, what happens to rise time?
Increase.
For a fixed domain, right? So the rise time, if damping goes up, my rise time is going to go up. What goes down? Settling time goes down. If this is bigger for a fixed omega n, I'm settling faster. What about overshoot? Right, so less overshoot as damping goes up. Right. If I want a faster rise time, what do I want damping, what do I want to happen? I want less damping, right? So I want less damping, but then that means I might have a longer settling time, right? For a given damping ratio, what happens as I increase omega n? Rise time is going to go down. What else changes?
Your peak goes up.
So I fixed zeta.
Peak goes down.
I fixed zeta. Right. So zeta isn't changing. And we're just varying omega n. Does my peak change?
Sorry, your peak time.
Peak time is going to change, sure. It's going to be a lot less. Does the peak itself, the amplitude of the peak, change? No, it doesn't. Right. So I can speed up the response and get the same peak. What about settling time? Right. So settling time will go down. So if I can tolerate, if I have a system and I can tolerate its current peak amplitude, and I have some way to increase its natural frequency, then I can do that and get a shorter settling time and faster rise time. Right? If it, as it exists, it has some damping ratio and some percentage overshoot, let's say. If that's within my tolerable limits, I know that if I have some way to increase omega n, then I could get kind of a better response in that type of system. It's going to be faster. So what we'll see is these equations end up being the foundation for us picking gains in our control system. Right. We'll see for the PID controller, which is the kind of most ubiquitous controller there is, really, that D part is just like changing zeta, right? The derivative gain, we'll say. The proportional gain is kind of like changing omega n in terms of its effects on the system. So we have these same kind of trade-offs. We can use these same equations to help us make the compromise to find a solution that meets our specs. Okay. So, questions about that?
I have a quick question.
Yep.
Can you give an example of how you would change the natural frequency?
Replace a spring with one that's a lot stiffer. Simplest way. Well, that's what omega n comes from, right?
Okay.
Right. Omega n's part of that Plant transfer function.
So I guess
omega n, so the systems we're talking about, if it's a mass spring damper, right, that omega n is just square root of k over m. Right. So if I put a stiffer k in there, my frequency goes up. But damping doesn't change. Other questions? Okay.
Would there be a situation where your rise time and your settling time basically are equal?
Yes.
And the omega is big enough that basically it's the same, right?
So you end up, if you have high damping, so these are actually all the ones we just talked about are assuming it's underdamped.
Okay.
Right? So they're actually different equations, and some of them are not known in closed form anymore.
Okay.
If you have overdamped or critically damped systems.
Yeah.
And for those, yeah, rise time and settling time are kind of the same almost.
Okay.
You also, if you have more complex controllers and more complex plants, you can end up with that same thing.
Okay.
So remember, these parameters here are all in response to a step input.
Okay.
So you could have some other kind of input here and still evaluate what the rise time to that input is. And if you pick that input correctly, rise time and settling time should be the same, which we'll see in a couple weeks. Okay, so test a week from today covering this stuff. Okay, and in terms of this stuff, you haven't had really any problems per se, but I think be able to talk about it just like we talked about it today. right? Oh, I could give you, here's a system, here's a response. I want the settling time to be shorter. What can I change to make that happen? Right. And not necessarily even asking for a value. Like, do I want damping higher, natural frequency higher? What's that kind of compromise there? So kind of for this latter part we have, since you haven't had problems yet, I feel it's okay to ask you qualitative questions about this stuff, more so than quantitative questions. I'll post, it'll be after 201 for sure, an outline of what to expect. Exam, no calculators, no notes or anything. I'll bring the paper for you. You're going to have a blank table in your pencil or pen. Okay. We'll see. I think there will be equations, but I'll provide an equation sheet. I'll post the equation sheet ahead of time. That'll be later this week before I get to that, though. All right, and then look for some problems. Won't have to turn them in, but I'll try to solve them before I post the solutions. I think is a good way to work through them.